and welcome to the Handbag Designer 101 podcast with your host, Emily Blumenthal, handbag designer expert and handbag fairy godmother, where we cover everything about handbags from making, marketing, designing, and talking to handbag designers and industry experts about what it takes to make a successful handbag. Welcome, Coral Chung, to the Handbag Designer 101 podcast. Coral, you are the founder and CEO of Sanrev.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
Sanrev, right? It's of a French origin. What brought on that word?
It means sense and dream. And the really core epitome I had when I started Sanrev was I wanted to focus on a woman who really combined different things. You know, it was about dichotomies coexisting. It's about being a woman who is career oriented and family oriented, who's creative, but also data driven, who loves, you know, things that are beautiful and luxurious, but also needs things in her life that work with her busy life that actually are practical and versatile. So I really like the combination of sense and dream and this idea that you could have the fantasy with the everyday. And there's this idea that you could juggle many things and you could have opposing forces combined to create something new. So that's really the inspiration for the birthing of Sanrev.
So let's take it way back. Where are you from originally?
So I actually was born in China. I was born in northern China, Manchuria, and I moved to LA when I was five.
Do you remember moving, like the whole process of being here?
Oh, I have very clear memories of a lot of these things, which is fascinating because I think it's very formative and really kind of guides how I think about the world and how I built Sanrev, but also just being really always thinking of myself as very bicultural, as a global citizen and having ties, you know, to a lot of different places in the world, and also not being afraid to go to a new place and take risk and so forth. So I feel like that was a really critical formative experience. So my parents were both grad students. And so they moved to the States when I was a baby, and I was with my grandparents for a few years before they felt ready for me to immigrate.
That seems to be very common. I mean, I have a...
So I think during that time, it was just really difficult for them because they were going to school full time, but obviously they needed to take on other jobs and to generate some income. And so they worked late every single day. You know, my mom had random odd jobs. I mean, she was a chemist by training and in China was a chemistry professor, but in the US, while she was going to school and learning English and so forth, she took on so many random jobs from waitress to nanny to Sunday school teacher to, you know, really anything that was available to her. And my dad was an engineer and, you know, he was studying computer science, but then he also became like a chef at a restaurant. So anyway, they both worked so hard pretty much 24/7. So it just didn't make sense for a baby to be living in that situation.
Do you remember the flight coming over? Do you have enough of a memory?
I remember. I came with my grandparents. And I think what I remember most was I had a lot of expectations about the US. You know, there's a lot of like sayings that I had in my mind, right? That as a little child, I interpreted very literally, you know? So for example, you know, I heard a lot about the American dream in San Francisco. The Chinese way of saying San Francisco has the word gold in it, right? So imagined all these things. And then, you know, I heard about like Disneyland and I just had this impression that like America is so amazing, you know, and the streets were lined with gold.
Gold.
Everybody's dreams came true, you know, like very and like, I would be living in some kind of fairy tale land. Basically, Disneyland is like... So that was my impression. And when you have high expectations like that, of course, you know, the reality is not going to meet your expectations.
Especially and you didn't speak English, did you?
I didn't speak English. And also my parents were still struggling and establishing themselves. So my grandparents had a really lovely house in China with a really big yard, and they, you know, it was beautiful. They grew strawberries and they had a cherry tree, and I grew up with my cousins, and it was it was really nice. And when I moved to the US, my parents were in a small one bedroom apartment.
Right.
You know, they had a roommate and there were cockroaches, and it wasn't the nicest situation. Right. And so I thought, wow, this beautiful land of dreams turned out to be something not so nice. But with your question about the flight, you know, what I do remember is landing at LAX and going to the bathroom at the airport. And I remember telling my mom at the time, oh, look, the bathroom smells nice. I guess they had some
the Lysol.
They had some, you know, air freshener or something like that. So that was good. That was a good thing. But then I exited the airport. I was like, ooh, it's kind of smoggy. And
yeah,
where is the Disneyland?
Right.
So that was my first impression. And then I started preschool and then kindergarten. And not knowing English was obviously a really hard adjustment. I just remember the first day of school, I was really thirsty, but I didn't know how to say water. So I was just kind of like, trying to explain to the teacher, you know. So that was also a big adjustment. But again, it just informed my risk profile and just my resiliency. And I think it was really ultimately a critical experience in my life.
Were there other Asian kids in your school?
There were. Yeah, there were, but nobody spoke Mandarin to me.
Right.
Yeah. And I think my parents were very keen on me learning English quickly.
So right.
They just put me out of the environment. Yeah, to be able to learn English. But then, you know, what's interesting is, of course, as a five-year-old, you learn things so quickly.
And yeah,
within a few months, I was speaking English fluently. I was reading books. I was, you know, it's just incredible how quickly children can learn.
Yeah.
And so at that, the real level, you know, she's going to forget how to speak Chinese, right? So then they got worried and started sending me to Chinese school after school and tried to immerse me in more Chinese culture. And so
make sure you and have as much homework as possible. So, yeah.
and like learn math, you know, and whatever, things like this. But I remember I was requesting to eat McDonald's and all the, you know, get a Happy Meal and stuff like that. And then they realized, wow, she's really getting immersed so quickly that we need to do a better job of
retaining our roots.
Yeah, retaining the different cultural, not just the language, but really the cultural elements that make her tied to her roots, right? So they really emphasize eating Chinese food and watching, you know, I watch the news every day.
Soaps.
Right. I watch the Chinese soap operas, all of that, right? Which I enjoyed. And so I think that really helped me retain my interest and also my language capability.
Was there an expectation that you needed to be a high achiever?
Absolutely. You know, I'm an only child. And so I think my parents were they had extremely high expectations. You know, everything had to be perfect. Everything had to be the best. There was really, but I also didn't, I know some people rebel against that. I did not. I kind of adapted to that expectation and I performed. You know, I was very high achieving throughout my childhood and I didn't have this experience of saying, well, no, I don't want to do that. You know,
right.
Except, you know, I ultimately had to quit piano because I wanted to focus on dance. But basically everything I pursued, I really pursued with excellence.
It was 110% plus.
Yeah, I pursued it with excellence. Yeah. And I think that was tough, you know, and it was a lot of pressure. And I think as a first generation immigrant, you always understand the struggle and the sacrifices that were made. And so I always feel
a responsibility.
I always feel that it was natural that I perform with excellence. And also my parents are very busy, right? So it was the type of thing where if I wanted them to come to a performance, right, I better be having a solo and better be performing in an excellent way. Like, for example, in dance or something like this, right? And my parents are very, you know, they're very discerning. They're very critical. They have a high bar about everything. And so I was just used to always getting that type of feedback from them.
Are you like that as a mom now, do you think? Or are you a little bit more
lenient? I try to be more balanced. But, you know, I think ultimately how you grow up is how it's like deeply seated in you. And so yeah. I have to catch myself and not just do that, right? I have to consciously change directions, you know, and it requires a lot more effort versus just letting your subconscious kind of take over and do what you feel is natural. So sometimes like I have to do things that don't feel as natural with my daughter. But, you know, my 10-year-old, I have a 10-year-old and a 2-year-old, and my 10-year-old is incredible. You know, she's an athlete. She's a dancer. She dances with San Francisco Ballet. She was young Cinderella in their, you know, professional production last year, right? Last season. So she's dancing at a level that is much more than right. me as a 10-year-old, because we have different access to resources and things like that, that my parents didn't, right?
Right.
And she's, you know, she's a competitive big mountain skier and, you know, is one of the top skiers in North America at her age level. And again, that's, you know, something that I never had exposure to as a child. My parents just didn't have access and resources to that. But I try to focus on it being fun and interesting for her and challenging. But, you know, I do think like, yeah, there's pressure for her to be really.
If she said, I don't think I want to dance anymore, would you be like, that's okay, I get it, let's just focus on something else? Or would you be like, okay, no, you've committed, let's see this through?
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up, because I think it's a very topical thing. You know, I think as she evolves, you know, she's kind of entering that preteen phase, right?
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of things will change. Actually, previously, she was very good at Kung Fu. And actually, when she was 5 years old, she was like sort of the five and under champion in California, you know? And so it's so funny, because sometimes like we'll see her trophies at home and my husband will lament like, oh, she was so talented.
She could have gone so far.
But, you know, she decided that she didn't want to continue doing that, because, you know, the reality is in that sport, as you progress, you have to do a lot of...
It's like 6 days a week. It's insane.
Well, you have to do a lot of sparring also. And she didn't like just beating other people up and getting beat up. I mean, she just didn't like it. You know, she liked doing the forms and the more... you know, the more dance oriented aspects of it in some ways, right? And so she just said, you know what, I know that if I progress, half the time someone will be beating me up and the other time I have to beat someone else up, and I don't want to do that. So we decided that she wasn't going to do that anymore. So that didn't happen. And, you know, COVID changed a lot of things too. She was playing musical instruments, and well, we have a beautiful piano in our home, and we relocated during COVID to Wyoming. And
I saw that. I thought that was a joke.
Well, we didn't have a piano there. You know, we got a keyboard. And, you know, it's interesting. She just really lost interest and she stopped playing. And my husband is very musical. My daughter's name is Aria. You know, like my two daughters have very musical names, Aria and Cadence. And, you know, music is really important in our family. And so she stopped playing piano. And that was sad. But, you know,
it is what it is.
I think it's too difficult to force something, right? And so I kind of believe in intuition and the natural flow of things.
Yeah.
And so to your question about dance, if she were to say that for me, I think the conversation we would have is probably similar to you. It's like, hey, we've committed to this period of time or this year, let's see this out. But at the end of this year, we can reevaluate, or at the end of this commitment, whatever that is, right?
Yeah.
We can reevaluate whether or not you want to recommit.
If I can, because all of this is a very interesting segue into what you've done and, you know, giving this 110%. I know you went to Penn, right? You have to be pretty smart to get in, some say. I'm assuming you had your act together. You were pretty solid. You go into finance, correct? Of some description. Talk a little bit about, you know, going there, getting your degree, and then getting your MBA from Stanford, and how all of that led to you becoming and falling into handbags. Because, you know, I told you, like, I started my handbag brand when I was getting my MBA, and that was something, even for my parents, that was a difficult thing for them to understand. Like, here I am,
you know, I was fortunate enough, they paid for school for me. Getting that extra degree with my family was really important. And here I am having the opportunities all over the place. And I was like, I think I'm going to start a handbag brand. I have an idea. I have a concept. I have it all mapped out. I did all the work in business school. This is how I'm going to do it. So how did your formative work years take you to San Rev?
I think what is really interesting is I feel like my path makes a lot of sense. You know, it's so interesting because from the outside, when you describe it, the way that you describe it, it's kind of like, whoa, it seems so random. Like, how did you end up here? Right. But actually, it's very interesting how logical and
methodical,
cohesive it is. Yeah. So, you know, I always had this very bicultural upbringing and I felt that I was always interested in international business. So my parents became, after grad school, they had a few other jobs, but they ultimately became entrepreneurs, right? So they went from technical academic people to entrepreneurs and had various entrepreneurial ventures. And so again, as an only child, I was immersed in that. And so I think that that was deeply seated in me that someday, you know, I would start a company and, you know, I don't know what it is, but it's just like so natural.
You knew.
There is not a lot of fear around it. And it was not always at the top of my consciousness, right? It was sometimes very far away, but it was just always there because, right. You know, I think as, again, as an adult, when I reflect on back on that, I feel like what a unique experience. But during that time, I didn't think anything of it. That was just my life. That was my childhood. I would go into the office with my mom. I would ghostwrite emails for my parents. You know, when I was 10 or 11 years old, I would write like emails to partners or lawyers or whatever, because, you know, I was a native English speaker, right?
And right.
So, and it's so funny. I like learned how to write these business emails, like, dear sir and madam, cold.
That's awesome.
Like, you know, at the time, again, I was just like, oh, this is fun. This is normal.
But it was so natural. Like, okay, this is what I do after school. This I'm going to go to work.
Yeah, this is what I do. You know, again, like I remember being a teen, you know, on the phone negotiating with a partner that was, you know, there was a frustrating situation and helping with that negotiation, right? I don't know if the other party realized the situation, but I do remember one time someone was on the phone with me and they were like, are you 12? And I was like, no, I'm 13. So anyway, that was just
that's a NPS. Big difference between 12 and 13. So respect.
Yeah. Yeah. So give me some respect.
Yeah, come on.
And so my parents, because I was an only child, they didn't have childcare or anything like that. They brought me to every business function, you know, business meetings. I traveled with them. I was just immersed, right? And kind of, it created some interesting opportunities for me. Like I was never afraid to interact with adults, right?
Because
I didn't have a sibling. So I was mostly interacting with adults. I was mostly interacting with people who were older than me. And I would be at these business dinners. And back then we didn't have devices and stuff. So sometimes I would read a book, but most of the time I was highly engaged in what they were talking about. And I actually understood what was happening. And I remember, you know,
I was networking. You were networking. Yeah, that's
it. I didn't realize I was, right? I was, right?
Yep.
And so I remember there was one dinner that I went to. And it's so funny because I think to the adults at this dinner, they probably just felt like I was some kind of novelty mascot type with, you know, he would provoke me, right? Like they would ask me these questions. They would be like, I mean, literally, sometimes they would be like, oh, I heard you dance. Can you do a dance for us right now in the middle of dinner? And I would be like, sure.
You know?
But so it just gave me a lot of resilience. But one time I remember this guy, I think he was being kind of obnoxious, but he was just asking me all these questions. He's from China and he was asking me like, oh, what's so great?
Was it in Chinese?
Yeah. Yeah. He was like, what's so great about being in America? And, you know, I was explaining these things to him and he's like, but, you know, ultimately you're born in China, so you're not really American. You can't even run for president. Right. I remember he was challenging me. And this, I was really little. I think I was like 9 years old or maybe... Yeah, I was definitely like younger than teen years. I was maybe 9 years old, maybe 10 years old, right? So I just had a really snappy response. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, we could change the Constitution, you know? And so he was really impressed by that.
Unlike China. So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But like, it was so interesting. He was so impressed by that, that I guess like a year or two later, I remember he had one of those really cool folding cell phones or something like that. And I just was playing with it, or I just said, oh, that's so cool and whatever. And so anyway, a year later, my dad gave me a present, and it was from this guy. And he said, you know, I was so impressed by our interaction. It had a little note that was like, oh, here's a present for the little girl who wants to change the constitution. So how cool is that, right? It's like these experiences that were totally ad hoc.
Right.
But, and again, even that interaction at the time, I didn't think was special.
Right,
I didn't
right.
think anything of it, you know? And I was just like, cool. He gave me a present, you know?
Yeah.
But now that I think about it, I'm like, wow, that's really cool, right?
Yeah.
Little kid, I did something. It was a memorable interaction. And, you know, he kind of thought about it a year later and whatever got me this thing. So I just had many experiences like that that made me feel like someday, you know, I would be a business person. I would be straddling multiple cultures and being an entrepreneur. And so when I went to Penn and Wharton, I actually had a very clear vision for what type of training and what type of experience I wanted to have in college for that. And so I did this program at Penn and Wharton called the Huntsman Program. It's a dual degree program. It's only for around 30 to 40 students every year. You have to have a language that you're essentially a native speaker of other than English. And so that's a very difficult requirement, right?
Yep.
So it's very specific and a very competitive program, but super international and really eclectic group of students and amazing, you know, high quality students. In my year, it was like, you know, the valedictorian of Philip Sexter, the Gatlin student.
And Coral.
Stuyvesant, you know, I mean, very impressive, right? And I remember I showed up just a girl from California and feeling so intimidated, like I didn't really know finance and investment banking.
Right.
I remember some of the boys were like, you don't even know what Goldman Sachs is? Like, why are you here?
If you ever wanted to start a handbag brand and you didn't know where to start, this is for you. If you had dreams of becoming a handbag designer but aren't trained in design, this is for you. If you have a handbag brand and need strategy and direction, this is for you. I'm Emily Blumenthal, handbag designer expert and handbag fairy godmother, and this is the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass. Over the next 10 classes, I will break down everything you need to know to make, manufacture, and market a handbag brand, broken down to ensure that you will not only skip steps in the handbag building process, but also to save money to avoid the learning curve of costly mistakes. For the past 20 years, I've been teaching at the top fashion universities in New York City, wrote the Handbag Designer Bible, founded the Handbag Awards, and created the only Handbag Designer podcast. I'm going to show you, like I have countless brands, to create in this in-depth course from sketch to sample to sale, whether you're just starting out and don't even know where to start or begin, or if you've had a brand and need some strategic direction, the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass is just for you. So let's get started, and you'll be the creator of the next it bag. Join me, Emily Blumenthal, in the Handbag Designer 101 Masterclass. So be sure to sign up at emilyblumenthal.com/masterclass and type in the code podcast to get 10% off your masterclass today.
I had one of those experiences when I had a flyback interview with Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
And my roommate was a BBA student at Michigan, and she was getting, they called them flybacks because they would fly you to.
Yes,
yeah. And so, yeah. And yeah, and they put us up in the hotel and all this very cool stuff. And, you know, at the beginning, they had the round table, and I was looking around and I'm like, oh my God, I am the only one who has not started a non-for-profit, isn't subsidizing my family, you know, hasn't, it's like just me, you know, I'm like, oh, I work for the Michigan Daily. I make a lot of money in advertising for them, you know, and they're like, and I said, okay, you could just go to the next person. So I get it. Not the same, but I totally get it where you're like, so where?
I just felt I had a chip on my shoulder. And I remember, again, the boys used to say, well, you know, not like all the pretty girls from California concentrate in marketing, right? And so I was very determined to be like, I'm going to take all the hard finance classes.
Right.
You know, I'm going to concentrate in finance. The Huntsman program is a dual degree. So I was getting 2 degrees, you know, Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts, and, you know, all in 4 years plus a study abroad. So it was like a lot. So I took on a lot in college. But again, it's this, you know, I was just, I wanted to pursue excellence. I also didn't like that people were telling me
you
that. Sometimes it was very overt and sometimes it was quite subtle.
Right. Yeah. Like, totally.
You know, and my first internship, I was the only young lady in that group, and just the culture was very, it was very interesting, you know, and it was very exclusive. It was very clear, like a boys club, you know, just
toxic adjacent.
All the things that they would do for the interns, it was like go paintballing, you know, it was just like a massive testosterone driven activities. And also like sometimes I was excluded, like after dinner, they would go
strip clubs.
And I wasn't invited, right?
I know.
And I was so naive. I would be like, oh, I want to join. And they're like, no, you should just go home.
Yep. Yep.
Or go back to the office. Go back to the office and finish that financial model.
And you would go.
I would. Because I was always like, you know, wanted to get that A+, right? I remember my boss at the time, I literally would hand him in some work. And then he would write an A. And I was like, can I get an A++? I'm going to give you a sticker.
Oh my God. And you were thinking, maybe, as long as everybody else can see, because I came back and you guys didn't. So there's that.
I mean, it was so anyway, after that experience, though, I realized I just didn't love that culture. And I thought the work was interesting, but not that interesting. And I learned a lot. And that's always how I approach things. It's like, you know, it was more for the experience and for learning, not necessarily like, you know, 20 years from now, that's what I want to do with my life. I also felt like there weren't really any true mentors for me. And again, I kind of look at, you know, who are the senior people and what is their life like? And I remember at the end of the summer, they took me out to a fancy lunch, you know, kind of like
yeah,
a fancy lunch and, you know, the corner table at this fancy lunch. And he drove me in his, you know, fancy Porsche 911. And it's like, isn't this amazing? Like, this is the life you could have. And I was nodding like, interesting. Not really. I mean, like, that's not really.
Like, good for you.
Yeah, great. Great.
Yeah.
That's not really exciting to me. So anyway, I ended up graduating and going into consulting and working in Hong Kong. And that was really one of the best experiences of my life. You know, it was exactly what I wanted to do in terms of being in a very diverse global environment. You know, Hong Kong at the time, it was right before the Beijing Olympics. It was really China was opening up. All the new businesses were growing, but also the multinational conglomerates were establishing headquarters there. And so I just worked on such interesting things. It was a really dynamic team. I was working in English and Mandarin really on a daily basis, and also traveling throughout China, you know, I was based in Singapore for a period of time, Taiwan for a period of time. And so as a 22-year-old, that was really the best experience. You know, it was hard and I worked so much. And I remember, Hong Kong housing, you know, people complain about New York or San Francisco. I mean, the housing in Hong Kong is insanely expensive.
Right.
And so living in this tiny little studio apartment, it was so small that, and I always loved fashion, right? So I had a lot of clothes and shoes and
small
stuff that I had to put all my suitcases in my shower. So I couldn't shower. So I had to shower at the gym every day.
Oh my God. I totally.
You know, it was like that, right? I couldn't. I had no space. And then I remember I was working so hard. I walked home at night, maybe at 2-3 a.m. from work, from the office. And my dad is like, isn't it like 3 a.m.? I was talking to him on the phone and he's like, it's time for you to fire them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. How did all these experiences, though, get you to Handbags? Because I understand the path and, you know, working at Bain and everything you've done is so, I don't want to say textbook because it's so minimizing and that's not what your career has been, because everything you've done has been like so top of the top. So like, this is what a high achieving, very successful person does, right? Everything you've done was like, you have to be not only lucky, but extremely smart, extremely hardworking,
and very much like, I'm pushing everything aside because I can do this and no one can tell me not to. How did all of those experiences get you to say, okay, now I'm going to start a handbag brand?
I really think that it's something that I was always interested in, curious about, felt there was opportunities and pain points in the market. But it was more just that I really felt the need to have more experiences, more training, build up my resume. And to your point, I was almost like collecting things for my resume, you know,
like skill sets.
Yeah, skill sets, but also like logos and brand names to a degree, right?
Yeah.
And so anyway, after Bain, I worked for a couple of startups and I really enjoyed that experience. I thought it was so interesting. I was so motivated and excited and it just felt like it was so tangible and I was making an impact. And so that gave me this instinct of like, ooh, I think I could do that too, right? And I also started meeting other founders and I realized that, you know, sometimes they just had a business background like myself, where they were ex-consultants and just saw this opportunity and started this company. And it wasn't the type of thing where they had specific technical expertise or they had specific industry knowledge. They just had an instinct and maybe point of view that was differentiated. And so I just felt like, you know, that's something that I have too. And so I ended up going to Stanford for business school. And during that time, I really got more into luxury retail and started to think about that as more of a business opportunity as opposed to a passion and interest. And I met some great mentors in the space and ultimately had an internship at Prada. And that was a really formative experience. And again, I just realized through that experience, there was so much opportunity in the e-commerce digital direct-to-consumer model, in the handbag category itself.
Were you sketching though? Like, was there something that was all like, while you were working for these companies, were you like, okay, I like this silhouette, this material speaks to me, you know, because a lot of creators like us, you know, what's the narrative and the origin of creating a handbag? It's an oversaturated market. What can you do that nobody else is doing? What price point can I hit at? I mean, all of the whys, but like decidedly, it always goes back to, I am missing something that I need. This is what I'm missing. This is what I would like to do with this handbag. Like, were you feeling all those feelings? And like, this is what I think my hero bag or my anchor piece would look like. Were all those things speaking to you while it was like starting to percolate?
It really started with the woman and her lifestyle, right? And started with this idea of like, what does a woman need in her life that's so critical to her? And that's when I started to think about more about the bag. And to your point, I was thinking about, why haven't I found the perfect bag? You know, I've been in fashion. I'm a very savvy consumer. You know, why am I not aware of what's out there? And it did start with that. And I think what happened actually was it really happened, you know, very instinctively and intuitively. But how?
And also not even being risk averse, considering what your background was about.
Yeah. So how Zenrev started was, I was at a conference. I was speaking at a conference in New York. And at the time, I was working for a tech company, big data analytics company, very successful company that later went public. And so I knew it was going to go public. I was leading the retail vertical there. So my clients at the time were, you know, major brands, major retailers, et cetera, ranging from Nordstrom to Apple and Sephora, Nike, et cetera. And during the panel, I was speaking and I had this crazy out-of-body experience where I was like, you know, myself speaking to me saying, why are you still at this company? You have so many ideas. You have such a strong point of view. Like, you really need to be speaking about those ideas at this juncture, right? And so on the flight back
from That's New like York, a movie.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. But on the flight back from New York to San Francisco, I just, for that entire, you know, 5.5-6 hour flight, I just wrote the entire business plan for
San Francisco. You know, they say on flights, you should never, ever sleep because of the altitude. It actually gives you a level of clarity that is like almost superhuman, that you're able to write things at almost a exponential rate that you could when you were on the ground. Like, I've written books on a flight, like, oh, look at this, all the,
I mean, whatever, a book,
but parts, I've actually never heard that before.
Yeah, they say that's why you're so much more productive on a flight. So it actually tracks that you were able like to see this through from start to finish. Like, okay, and this is what it would look like. And here's the customers and here's where it would sell and here's the prices and so forth. So you came home. Were you with the company when it went public?
No. So that was a really hard decision because I wanted to start SunRev and but I also had, you know, I had stock options and I knew it was going to be worth something. And so I had to walk away from that. But basically what happened was I started executing different parts of the business plan and was, you know, SunRev was sort of nights and weekends and I was still working at this company at the time. And so after about 6 months of that, I realized SunRev had potential and it was real. And so
You found a sample maker? Had you found a manufacturer?
I started exploring this. And again, I started meeting different people in the industry and getting introductions to people. And so I got, you know, some introductions to sample makers and things like that. But
did you have them done domestically, your first samples?
So at that time, I didn't actually execute on the samples yet. I left my job, my full-time job, and then I started working on that.
You had the process and order of operations mapped out. And then it was like, okay, now I just need to figure out and make the product. And then I'm set.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did some market testing and consumer research and things like that.
Can I just to interrupt? And I'm sorry. What you're just saying is the case study that I always speak to, that homework is free. Research is mostly free, but mapping out the product, the who, the why, and everything is always the way to go before you spend any money on actual product. Because at least when you actually get to that point, you have it almost so narrow casted and down to a science as to this is what it looks like. This is who it is. I've already done my market test research. All I need to do is get the physical bag in their hands to validate what they already said. So not that I need to say I applaud this, but it just like that's how it's supposed to be done.
Yeah. And I think the reason I was able to do that had a lot to do with my prior experiences, my consulting training, my business training, and, you know, my network, right? My relationships and my network. So all of these really factor into how things were started and the momentum I was able to generate in the early days. And then,
Was there anything that, like, once you hit the launch button, was there anything that, you know, coming from your background, seeing your parents do what they've done, was there any fear or risk of failure? Because you can't be 110%. You can't overachieve with something that is so many factors are now officially out of your hands. Like, things go wrong that you can't control, right? How did you handle those situations?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of challenging situations. So we started with doing some domestic sampling, and then I went to Italy a lot. And also at that time, I had a, you know, 3.5-year-old, 4-year-old child. So it was so hard. It was a lot. And my husband actually decided to launch. He was a investor at a large Silicon Valley firm, and he decided to launch his own fund. And so we were both kind of doing entrepreneurial things with a small child, and I was traveling all the time. He was traveling all the time. So like, there were so many things about how that time was really difficult and out of control to a degree. And so I think, yeah, you just have to manage through the chaos. You know, I think back on that time, and sometimes I think it was quite fun, right? I think like the time before you launch is really precious because it's just sort of like, it's your baby, it's your idea at that time, right? You don't have all the different obligations that you do after it becomes materialized. So I actually look back and really enjoy that time. But I took a lot of time to learn the business, to learn the industry, to learn the technical aspects of creating a bag, the design in and out. So I took about a full year to do that before we launched, right? So I met with countless factories in Asia and the US and Italy. And ultimately, I felt like Italy had really the hand and the quality that I wanted. And
were you able to interact with the factories in an educated way? Because that's always a tricky step, because if you show up green, they treat you as such and you get charged as such. So,
well, that's why I did a lot of pre-work, you know, sampling and whatnot in the US. I just, again, had countless meetings, different individuals, groups, you know, I just at that point was really up the learning curve and knew to ask the right questions. And I knew enough, right? I was up the learning curve at that point. So I think, you know, that's one of those takeaways where it's important to do your homework and do that pre-work.
Yeah, 100%.
Sometimes it feels like a waste of time or it's going slower than you would like. But for me, it always ended up being useful. You know, it was never wasted time. It was time that I needed to learn all of this.
Yeah. Yeah. So where is SANREV today and where do you want it to be in the future? What is big picture SANREV for you, Coral? What would be the mapped up plan that you already have for it? Because I'm sure it already is in terms of, you know, it's so interesting because you have all this data and analytics and, you know, reality sometimes hits and it forces you to pivot and pandemic happens that forces you to pivot. So, you know, where has all of this taken you and what do you want for the future?
Yeah, it's really crazy, you know.
And being in Wyoming,
it's really crazy. The pandemic, being in Wyoming, having another baby, you know, all of these things are crazy things that life throws at you. And I think for me, I just have a really open mind about it, you know, and I'm very optimistic. I always have an optimistic outlook on things. And when something bad happens, I always think about how, well, it's just more interesting drama for the book later, right? Yes, this appendicitis episode that I just had will make it into the book.
Oh my God. You need a bag that's the shape of an appendix. I can't wait for the silhouette to come out.
Well, it's funny because one thing that I realized is I generate a lot of energy from being creative. I'm just such a creative person. And part of that was suppressed during my upbringing because, you know, I wanted to be on that academic, you know, quantitative path, right? But I actually am very creative. So I did a painting and I commemorated it by calling it the appendix. So there will be a painting on that level called the appendix hanging in my office.
That's amazing.
So anyway, it's not literal. It's a very abstract painting.
I am assuming an excluded appendix is quite abstract.
I had someone come look at it to frame it. And that person was like, oh, is it a painting of a waterfall? And I was like, oh, that's so interesting. Thank you. But anyhow, so the vision for SANREV is really for SANREV to be a iconic global brand, right? That's really what I've always wanted. I really want it to be just an impactful and valuable brand and product in a woman's life, you know, operate at a scale that's really meaningful and impactful and continue to bring really beautiful and luxurious and versatile products into the world. We have a really high bar for every product we bring in. You know, it needs to have a unique place. It's so thoughtful and considered and every single detail. And I think that's really our philosophy. And I think it's also hard, you know, with the pandemic, with all the things that have happened. It's been a difficult journey, but I do think that it's very rewarding and super fulfilling. And there's nothing that makes me happier or more excited than to see someone, a stranger, you know, wear one of our bags at a restaurant or at the airport or wherever. Or
do you chase them down? I do. Just stop.
Sometimes. Looking at.
Oh, really?
Sometimes, I would. And then sometimes people would approach. And there was one time I was in Philadelphia and I was at a museum and there was a woman. I was wearing an Aria bag and there was another woman with her child wearing an Aria bag. And she came up to me and was like, wow, you know, it's so funny. We had a great conversation. And so,
were you like, and then here's my Aria right over there?
Yeah. And it's just so fun. You know, I find that to be so rewarding. And I love the tangible nature of the products. I really love the development process and how creative that is. But I also understand, you know, running a business is you have to wear many hats and you have to do things that sometimes don't play to your strengths or not the most fun things, but that's all part of the job, you know, or, you know,
yeah.
do things that are really difficult, make difficult decisions. You know, that's also part of the job. So I am enjoying the journey, even though there are a lot of hard parts to it. And I do think that what SendRef can become and continue to develop into is, you know, it'll be always a product-driven brand, but I want it to have that lasting power, you know, and that lasting impact. And I think, you know, as the woman evolves, we have evolved, right?
Right.
We really talked about our brand and our brand values and our brand story. And what is it that we're doing for this woman that we want to serve? You know, how are we making her life more inspired, or how are we making her day happier, or how are we making her a little bit more empowered to have versatile products in her life? So that's something that's always constantly top of mind. And the other thing I find very fulfilling is working with a team of mostly women who are very passionate, very creative, very energetic, and I derive a lot.
Are they in Wyoming now, or they're still in California?
We have a virtual team. Most folks are in New York or California, but we have folks in like Denver and Virginia, and I have a small team in China. I mean, we're very spread out.
Right.
And I myself, you know, spend a lot of time in New York. That's where the appendix situation happened. I had to get that appendectomy.
You should have told me. I would have brought you a sandwich.
But thankfully, you know, NYU Hospital is a really great hospital.
Definitely the one where you want your appendix to accidentally explode.
It was really top notch medical care. But yeah,
Did you take it home? I guess you couldn't.
No, that's really funny that you asked that, because the only other person who asked that was my mom. She was like,
"Listen,
did you get it in a cooler to bring it home?"
And I was listen, like, she and I get her, I feel her, I respect her. We're on the same page. Listen,
yeah, clearly.
If she made you, then honestly, she knows what she's doing. So,
were you one of the women who took the placenta home and like turned it into pills?
No, because it's disgusting, in my opinion. My husband was very kind to take pictures of it because he thought that was funny. And I was like, absolutely not. But by the third kid, like I told you, I asked them to weigh the bowl, weigh the placenta. I really wanted to know how many pounds I was off, including the baby, because I was like, I know the baby, but this was a long time and that placenta looked hearty. So I told them my placenta must have been at least 25 pounds because I was hoping to lose like 10 after we were said and done. They're like, it was like an ounce, something like that. I felt very, very shortchanged. It was so rude. Coral, how can we follow, learn more, become more SendRef stands, talk to us? How can we get our hands on those beautiful bags?
Well, we love community building and really, you know, I find women who love our products, they're all very naturally connected to each other. So I love that, you know. And so please follow us on social at SendRef. Visit our website at SendRef.com. You can chat with us. You can reach out to us anytime at hello@SendRef. We're always engaging in a dialogue. We're so feedback oriented. And we do, as a team, listen and talk about, you know, everything that people share, comments and direct messages and things like that. So we love all of that. So please be in touch and reach out and look us up, follow us on Instagram, on TikTok, etc.
Every platform. And that's SanReve, correct?
SenRev.
SEN. Damn, I blew it. That's what I meant. SenReve. Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Coral, it has been an absolute joy. I'm so happy we are connected. Next time in New York, you must find me. We will absolutely go out and I'll bring you that sandwich.
Sounds amazing.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate and review and follow us on every single platform at Handbag Designer. Thanks so much. See you next time.